Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us for a special edition of Movie Mentors. I'm your host, Jeremy Boros, and today we're talking to the fabulously talented TV writer and producer, Wendy Calhoun. Getting her start in unscripted television, Wendy has been a groundbreaking and prolific producer of some of the most cherished and highly rated TV shows of the last 20 years. Whether it's Giving Us Hell in Gordon Ramsay's Competitive Kitchen, or penning emotional and thought-provoking scenes for Empire, Nashville, or Justified, Wendy routinely breaks the barriers of what's possible for high-quality, inclusive entertainment both on and off the screen. Not surprisingly, she's also a passionate and joyful conversation, so I'm super delighted to share our Zoom chat with you. And while we're on the subject, I just want to say that this is an environmentally friendly interview, meaning not only did we stay at home to conduct it, but the ambient sounds of two responsible quarantiners' environments will also be present. So please, get over it and enjoy my chat with Wendy Calhoun. Wendy Calhoun, it is so delightful to see you on this virtual interview on Zoom. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. It's delightful to be here and to be healthy and safe. And you look healthy and safe, so this is all good.
Thank you. Yes, I am. And how are things going given like the circumstances for you as a writer? How are you keeping busy? Are you pitching? Are you working on what?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of things. It's interesting. I mean, it'll take more than a pandemic, I think, to slow my creativity. literally, yes. I mean, one of the first things that I've done over the past month, it's interesting. Let me back up a minute. I was in New York. I was on set for Prodigal Son up until March 13th. That's when I flew back. And so it was kind of in my own self-imposed quarantine for those last couple of weeks of March because, you know, I wasn't sure if I had been exposed or not. During that time, I just started building what I call my digital studio. I took a room that I have in my house that I normally have a whiteboard up, and I put story cards up and put story ideas when I'm breaking stories for whatever I'm writing. And I converted it into a room where I could do, you know, Zoom calls and pitches. So partly for fun, but mostly for work, I had already scheduled to pitch a new unscripted series. And so I've been doing that virtually from my new snazzy studio. And, you know, also have been brainstorming because I've been thinking about ways that I could share my knowledge. Honestly, I've been working full-time as a television writer producer for 20 years now. I did the math and I've really been out here for quite some time and have gathered a lot of knowledge, obviously done a lot of public speaking about it, you know, whether it's a panel or, you know, any kind of event, and even outside of the United States. And I thought, well, I think it's time to build that YouTube channel. It's time to build that sort of digital platform where I can start to curate some of the things that I've been developing in time of how to help other people, how to teach what I do. And so I've been brainstorming on that and taking online courses on how to live stream and then how to build a YouTube channel. And so I've just been diving into that. And then also I in terms of writing and a podcast that I developed, that podcast, what I've been doing is adding visuals to a lot of it, and figuring out ways to bring that into the digital live stream space. I've stayed very, very creative.
I was gonna say, wow, that is a lot. You're really making the most of it. I feel like you need your own masterclass. You know those masterclass.coms? We need one with you.
I would love that. As a matter of fact, the problem is I'm a masterclass junkie, so I binge masterclasses.
Me too.
You do too? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, my gosh. The one with the FBI investigator. I loved that one.
Okay.
I did RuPaul's. I did, Sarah Blakely, the lady who founded Spanx.
Yep.
Loved that. There was one I just binged now. I can't remember. Oh, Goodby, the advertising company.
I've got to watch those. We've watched other ones.
I'm Spike Lee. Spike Lee's on
Spike
my
Lee.
List. I got to
yes.
do that one.
Yeah.
So I do like to... I find with my masterclass taste, I like to do people who are outside of entertainment industry because I'm so curious about their industries and they do speak to a lot of what we do. So I'm hugely into masterclass. If I make it that big that I have a masterclass, oh my gosh.
Well,
oh my gosh, that would be a dream come true.
I'm hoping that this podcast is a little mini appetizer of what that could be.
Okay.
No pressure, no pressure, no pressure. No, but Wendy, you know, when I met you were moderating that amazing panel at Film Independent on the TV writers, and you did a fantastic job. And I remember when I walked out of there with a couple of friends, I was like, man, that was a great panel, but really, that moderator was so good. She was so inspirational. She was so positive. She, you know, had so much wisdom to share that you managed to interject between the other people's responses. So I guess off of what you just said, is you just diving straight into your creative energy, the thing that keeps you spiritually afloat during times like these and just in general, because you really do radiate joy. So are you a spiritual person? Are you, how do you negotiate all that?
Yeah, definitely. I'm a spiritual person. I think my spirituality comes from a place of meditation and maybe some of more of the things you would know from Zen Buddhism. And I mean, I was raised in Christianity my whole life, and that's definitely something that I have a connection to historically and also culturally, honestly. But oddly enough, I wrote for a show called Life years ago. It starred Damian Lewis, and his character was a guy named Charlie Cruz, who had been accused of murdering his partner and was convicted of murder, but it was found out that he was wrongly imprisoned, wrongly accused. So for the character Charlie Cruz, Zen Buddhism got him through prison, and it was a really important component to who he was as a character. So I did what I normally do, which is fully immersive research. It's not enough for me to just read that and not just read Alan Watts, which was the book he read. And he was also listening to tapes. It was actually a part of the show where he would be listening to Zen Buddhism tapes in his car. And so we would use all these little, a lot of different phrases and things from that. So my immersive research was that I started going to the Zen Center of LA, and I took Zen Buddhism classes, and then I just got really involved, and I found that in a really interesting way. I think I had been disconnected spiritually for a little while since I'd been out in Los Angeles and moved away from home. It wasn't a part of my weekly practice, if you will, going to church and that sort of thing. But the practice of the Zen Buddhism brought me back to that. And I started going to the First AME Church in Los Angeles, which isn't far from my house. That was to have a cultural connection again to the church and the Black community. And it's a very important part of the Black experience. But then also just the Buddhism part has never left me. Like, I just have never stopped it. I love the practice. I love reading about it. I love understanding that philosophy. It's given me a philosophy of life. And it's gone beyond just, you know, a moment of research. Now it really is kind of infused into everything I do. There was a time in my life where, especially when I first got out of NYU, where I was struggling because I really didn't know, I didn't feel like I had a philosophy in life yet. Like, I was searching, I was on the search, but I hadn't landed. Once I made that landing and found something that connected to me, and like I say, it was completely through happenstance. It sought me in a weird way before I saw it. Like, it came to me. And once I committed to it, though, and added it to my life, it gave me a sense of peace and understanding. And then I started finding other ways to find that same sense of peace even outside of the Buddhism. I've completed three LA marathons, which,
Wow.
you know, that's a great lesson for life and philosophy, because I did it with the LA Roadrunners, and basically you start in September to get ready for a marathon that usually happens in March in Los Angeles. So that's, you know, a good 8 months of training, getting ready for this long, long journey, and you learn a lot. You learn a lot about the mind's ability to push past pain. Pain is temporary. The importance of practice, that discipline that comes with training for a marathon, is really instructive for the discipline I think it takes to write a great script. It's the same sort of way of thinking that you show up every day, you work out, you do it. You know, there's going to be some days that are painful. There's going to be some days you really don't want to. You push past it, and then when the day comes for the big race, it's almost like the race itself is secondary because the training, the journey, that was what was important. For me, there was a huge lesson that I had to learn in my career. For a long time, it was all about the product. So that was, you know, finish the script, get the job, what I learned through the process of some of those things, like I said, practicing the Buddhism, doing the marathon, it really truly is the journey. It really is every single day. So every single person right now who loves to write can be writing right now, and that is it. You are already there. That the process in itself is what's rewarding. It's not the end result. And I think once you start to understand that, you start to live a fulfilled life as a creative person.
Well, speaking of journeys, let's dive into yours a little bit.
Sure.
You grew up in Dallas, right? How did Dallas inform you as a person and ultimately your interest and career?
Yeah, I mean, I had a full circle moment. I think it was last year. I got to speak at a Dallas Arts Breakfast, and the mayor was there, and it was really cool because I got to kind of answer this question with the mayor there and my parents
Oh.
listening. It was a big deal, because Dallas is the it's a big little city. It doesn't know its size. It's like I likened it to a chihuahua. It's like a little dog, but it thinks it's giant. That's Dallas.
Okay.
So, and it loves the arts. So you can be someone who wants to create, in my case it was theater, wants to create theater in Dallas and actually get a play you wrote, produced, and actually get actors, great actors, to act in it and see it on its feet. Like it's big enough to where you can do all these things, but small enough to where you actually can have access and a voice. So growing up there, it was really amazing. I mean, I got to do all kinds of things. I had, like I said, plays produced. And this is me at 16, 17 years old.
What was the play about? Do you remember?
The very, very first play I wrote was about a young black female on the south side of Chicago. By the way, I didn't write again about Chicago until Empire. Well, I was in Chicago for Empire, but like I didn't even think about Chicago. I had never even been to Chicago when I wrote this play. I
This
just knew.
sounded
I knew the South Side was supposed to be gritty. And so
good.
she needed a job, and she starts working at this hardware store, and she has an opportunity. As I'm saying this out loud, it's gonna sound so me, right? You know what I've written now since this was my 15-year-old self, this is what I was writing, which is not far from this. So she had an opportunity to get in on this like robbery ring, and she has to decide, should she make that choice or should she make choose to do the right thing? So it was all about that and the relationship between her and her bosses who are working in this little hardware store on the south side of Chicago. And this moment of her making that choice was going to change her life. So that was that story. Crime, check.
Sounds good. Sounds
Brittingham,
good.
check.
We don't really change that much.
I know. Somebody recently showed me an article that I had written that was published in, I believe it was either the Dallas Morning News or one of the other local newspapers. And I was writing about ways that I thought that Dallas could prevent crime. And so I've been obsessed with crime and, I don't know, soapy, all this kind of stuff for a long time.
You get into NYU. Right. So did you apply as an actor or a writer or film?
So I applied to NYU. My good girlfriend in high school had her heart set on NYU. I had never thought about New York, but I knew Spike Lee went there, so I had to go check it out. I should back up a little bit. Spike Lee was a big influence because here was a guy who was not only writing it, but he was directing it. He was in it. He's promoting it. It was his voice. I saw that and I thought, well, if he can do it, well, maybe I can do it. And he went to NYU. Well, maybe I should go to NYU. It was, it's like, if you can see it, you can be it. I really believe that. And he had a huge influence on me just by being who he is, having a voice out in the world and owning that voice. I just thought it was amazing. And I got to say this to him. I gave a speech at the 50th Tisch anniversary stage, and I got to get a hug from Spike, which was a big deal for me. As a matter of fact, I don't want to say this right now. I want to put this on the record because I've been living with this for a couple of years now.
Do
He
it.
asked me on stage. He says, "Are you a teacher?" And at the time, I said no. Now, at the time, I said no because first of all, I'm on stage at Lincoln Center, and I'm not thinking. Second, I'm thinking, "Gosh, here I'm with Spike Lee. Now, he's a teacher. I can't say that I'm a teacher." But the I think back to that moment now. I've been thinking about that for a long time now. Of course, I'm a teacher. Every writer is a teacher. I've been teaching every day, since I've been a part of this business. So, Spike, if you're out there and you're listening, yes, I'm a teacher.
Well, teach us and share with us how you got to this other side of the circle. Right out of school is such a pivotal, crucial time for so many people. How did you get into the unscripted world?
Yeah. Oh, so that journey. Okay. So it started about a month before I was knew I was going to leave New York. What happened was we're coming towards, you know, finishing the school year, and you like everybody else, all the other seniors, trying to find a job, right? And at that time in New York, we were in a deep recession. And hopefully this will be instructive for everybody as we're coming out of the pandemic. There's going to be those times where, you know, you really have to get crafty. Crafty is the word. So we were in a deep recession. And I'm going up for jobs in New York, I wanted to get a job in New York so badly. But I was going up against people who had 10 more years experience than me and willing to do it for less money than I could afford to live on. Like, it was crazy. So at that point, I thought, well, I got to move to LA. And that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to cold call people in the alumni directory. It was about a month before I was supposed to finish. And just see if I can set up anybody in development who'll meet with me in LA. That was a whole process, the whole thought. I just need to make a connection because I knew nobody in Hollywood. Not a single, I didn't even know a janitor. I didn't know anybody. Parking lot, valet, nobody. Gardener. Nobody. So I had no connections. So I did call and it was cold calling, literally. And one guy took my call, Richard Rothstein, I'll never forget you. He was working as a director of development at a company out here at the time. And Richard took the call. There were a lot of people who didn't even take my call.
What were you saying on the call? Hi, I just graduated from NYU.
Hi, you're an NYU alumni. Well, I'm just finishing NYU and I'm coming to Los Angeles and I want to work in development and you're working in development. I was hoping maybe we could meet and you could give me some advice.
You're hired.
No, it wasn't quite like that, but I did, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do something crazy like that. I did come out to Los Angeles. It did not occur to me until I got here that maybe he wasn't going to actually go through with what he said his first meeting. Like, there was a moment of panic. I was like, oh no, I didn't really have a backup plan. I didn't have a plan B. This guy said he'd meet with me and that was enough. Luckily, he did meet with me. And he said, well, I'm going to introduce you to three of my other friends. They're all working in development. One of them at the time was Tim Burton's assistant. Another one was a development executive at what was called Beacon Pictures at the time. And I forget the third. It was terrible. But I met with them. And I remember, I eventually was Tim Burton's assistant, but this is years later. But made friends with them. And then really it was within like 2 weeks, got a call from one of those ladies who said, hey, they needed an assistant over at this agency in literary, and you know, working in an agency will give you a good overview of the business. Why don't you go interview? I was like, oh, sure. I got the job. That was a month after I'd moved to Los Angeles. So it took me a month, but I got the job and it was off of a cold call.
they're scary, but they're worth it.
They're scary. Yeah.
So few people do them, and that's why.
Yeah. Well, because there's a lot of rejection. Now everyone's, you know, cold emailing or whatever. But I do think that there's something to be said for, you know, like you did, go to a film independent, go to some place where you know creative people are going to be meeting and starting to build your network, starting to meet people, starting to let people know what you're interested in so that they can, if they connect with you, they'll help you. Well, people do help other people. And then also being flexible. You know, I think if I come out here and said, well, no, I only want to be, you know, this, and been really rigid, some opportunities probably would have gone away, but I was pretty flexible. You know, people said, yeah, I know you came out here to find a development job, but actually working in an agency is going to give you a better overview of the business. Why don't you give it a shot? And me being willing to say, okay, I'll give it a shot. You know, instead of like being hunkered down on just one notion of what I thought I needed, because you don't know.
That is a recurring theme on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Everyone I've talked to has said, do everything, do anything you can, because when you're just right out of school, you think you know a lot, but you don't really, and just learn and just be a sponge and absorb as much as you can in any aspect of the industry, especially, you know, if you feel like you may have inclinations toward producing, because that's obviously such a great way.
Because producing, you need to know all of that. That job, that was forever ago. It still helps me understand, like, I understand how agents approach a negotiation. I understand, you know, that's something that pays off for me all the time because I'm always negotiating some deal. The art of negotiation is something you should just learn and know from any place you can learn it.
Was Tim Burton a mentor, or were you, was it more just a clear-cut
No, he
assistant
was just,
job?
no, it was an assistant job. It was fun. It was amazing to see somebody with that level of access and privilege. Like, whoa, like you could have anything you wanted, kind of thing. I'd never been to that kind of candy store. No. So that was wild to see. And also, I think, now I've had time to reflect, the big takeaway from Tim was like, you never came to him with just one idea. Like, you had better have plan B, C, D, and E, because you would present him with what you knew was a great option for whatever he needed, and he was going to say, okay, yeah, what you got, what else you got? You just so you know so you stumble at that once and you never do it again. So I still kind of approach even story that way. Like, we'll go into the room, even let's say prodigal, and we're coming up with story ideas, and maybe we land on something. We know it's a great idea. Oh my God, it's such a great idea. It's gonna be great. And I'm always like, okay, guys, what's the alt pitch? Like, because if we bomb on this one, we better have a backup plan. You don't know what Warner's or Fox or the showrunners or whoever's gonna come back at you, or maybe there's some reason why that great idea just isn't right for this particular moment in time. So I'm always coming up with alt, and I learned that from Tim. The alt pitch, you better have it.
Is that a responsibility writers have when they're on set as well, if they're allowed on set?
Yes. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You'll be in the trenches. A scene isn't working. You need to be able to figure out why it's not working, and you can offer some solutions to the director, offer solutions to the performers, and maybe that first solution is just it's not important. Maybe it's satisfying one area, but hurting another one. That's where you gotta have that next idea, and not be afraid. It also helps you. Like, the Silicon Valley has this wonderful phrase, and I don't mean the TV show, I mean the actual place, called, fail fast, right? And that's kind of true. When you have an alt idea, you're not afraid to fail fast, because you got another plan. I think you're afraid to fail when you only have one plan, right? If there's only one solution, then you're kind of nervous about your solution. But if you got solution B, C, and D lined up, you're not worried about it.
Yeah, says the lady who moved to LA and New York without a plan.
I know,
No,
I know. Hypocrite.
no, no. First question about Hell's Kitchen. Well, actually, before that, was your blood pressure as high making that show as it was for me watching it?
Well, it was, but from adrenaline, because I was so excited. You have to understand, I had 2 years before Hell's Kitchen had ever aired, I had been pitching an unscripted cooking show to the broadcast networks. And I remember an executive at CBS telling me, oh, a cooking show will never work on broadcast. So it was really, I was upset. I was upset, especially when Hell's Kitchen season one came out and I saw it. Now, it was pretty, if you saw Hell's Kitchen season one, it was pretty rickety. I mean,
Yeah.
it was just
It's
barely,
early.
it was rough. It was
Beta.
rough.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh my God, they did it. They've got a cooking show on broadcast. I gotta find this person. And at the time, my manager knew Kent Weed, who was one of the creators of the show. And Hell's Kitchen season one had just played. They didn't know if Hell's Kitchen was gonna get a pickup for season two. I said to my manager, I've got to meet him. That show's amazing. I know I could make it great, and I know I should be on it. I chased him down. Finally got a meeting with him. Didn't know if the show was gonna come back. By the way, this is a really important tool to share. Take the gamble. Take the gamble on something you love before it's ready, because those are the people they remember. So I'm here coming to him before he even knows if he's got another season, and I'm saying, if you do, I will be here for you. And that means something to him at that time. If I had waited another season, oh, is it a hit yet? He ain't got time for me. He got five other people that lined up that came for this. But I get there faster. I get there ahead of them because I truly believe in the project, and that really matters. And sure enough, they got a second season. So that was a gamble, but it happened. It paid off. And sure enough, he called me. I went in. I got the job. So my blood pressure was high because I was ecstatic.
Yeah.
I loved it. And even to this day, when I think about that season that I worked on Hell's Kitchen, that's one of my favorite jobs I ever did. It was great.
Why? What specifically?
Oh my God. That show at that time had 72 cameras, six steady cams. We're in a master control room that looks like something out of Hunger Games. There was a team of, I think there must have been 12 producers. I'm still friends with several of those producers to this day. A lot of women, a lot of people of color working. Like it was, I'd never seen anything quite like it in Hollywood. It felt inclusive. It was exciting and fun. And what we were doing was a little dirty. You know what I mean? Like
Oh,
we were being rebels, right? Gordon
totally.
was a rebel. And so it was just fun. And I got to go into the field. I had a lot of creative leeway. They sent me to Texas and I think I must interview like seven of the contestants that year that were coming from Texas. Like I did their initial interviews. I met with their families, shot all their B-roll packages. I'm directing in the field. This is amazing. And it's gonna be on Fox. Are you kidding me? I'm thrilled. I come back, we shoot the show. Shot in 20 At that time, it was shot in like a month, 28 days, and 6 days a week you work. It's intense, a lot of work. And then for months, maybe 4 or 5 months, we went into post, which is where the writing is done. And there were times where I had three or four bays going at once, with different sections of the story, going from editor, editor, editor. It was, I just was, I was really pushing on all cylinders. So, the thing about that is, I was in the process of editing the finale, got a call from a manager. And that year was the 5th year that I've been trying to jump into scripted television. 4 years before that, I had been going to meeting after meeting after meeting and getting really, really close and not getting the job, not getting the offer. It's really heartbreaking after that many years. You start to think, what's wrong with me? Why am I doing this? That year, where I'm at, where really, for me, as an unscripted producer, I'm feeling like I'm at the top of my game. I'm so happy. That year, I got one call for one staffing job on a scripted show, and I almost didn't want to go. I remember my editor saying to me, "Why? You just don't go." I'm like, I've been doing this for 5 years. Let me just go. They're not going to give me the job. It doesn't matter." I go into the meeting. I'm meeting with this man who's written all these great shows, and I literally said to him in the meeting, "There's nothing I can say to impress you." Like I was so sure I was never going to get it. It was never going to happen for me. And I was already happy. I was doing something that I was happy. And anyways, I broke all the rules for what you're supposed to do in a staffing meeting. You're not supposed to pitch the showrunner ideas. I'm like, "Here's what you can do to make the show better." Like I just didn't care. And I swear to you, within 2 hours, I got a call. They want you to start on Monday. I had to quit my dream job and go on this other journey that I had started 5 years before that had rejected me 4 years. And that year, I had one meeting, and boom, it happened.
Wow. So while you were producing Hell's Kitchen, did you also have any time to be writing?
I think I'm pretty sure I wrote a script before Hell's Kitchen, I'm sure of it, because I was writing a new piece every year. I would always write a new piece, but not while I was doing the show. No, I didn't have time. It was too intense. And like I said, at that point, year five, I was thinking that's not going to pay off. I was already thinking of alt pitches for my life. Should I write a feature? Should I write another play? Because moving into the scripted television realm, it just didn't seem like a club that wanted me as a member. They just felt like closed doors. I didn't know why, but it just wasn't happening. I do know that when I first started going out on those staffing meetings, diversity was almost a dirty word. There was a time period where there were a lot of writers who didn't feel like they needed to have diverse voices in their room.
Yeah, you've said in your videos that on the first two seasons of Justified, you were the only female writer.
That was only 10 years ago. So that's how rapidly we've come, where people are understanding the importance of diversity, and but whether it be gender or of color in their writing room, there was a long time when people felt like, I don't know, that sort of the words I've been using lately is white male aesthetic was enough, and that the white male could write the voices of everyone, and you didn't need the voices from other POVs.
Tying that into our earlier conversation about spirituality, how did you process that, navigate that for yourself to break through those barriers?
I don't know how I processed it. I think I still am processing it every day. But I think navigating it, certain things, certain way to do it was through the research, because I'm a woman of color and my voice has never been a dominant voice in popular entertainment. I always had to do that extra research to really understand those other voices that aren't don't come naturally to me, to understand them, learn how to write them. And what that means is that I don't take for granted that my voice is mainstream at all. And because of that, it makes me an equalizer when it comes to characters, because I don't assume that my voice is mainstream black female either. I do just as much research for a cookie as I do for a Boyd, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I just assume that I'm an outsider. And so that's one of the ways I've navigated it, was never just, I just never look at myself as being on the inside. Although I feel like the longer I stay in Hollywood, the more inside I probably get. And because of that, I try to go out of my way to find characters outside of Hollywood for inspiration. And I do a lot of that. I love to create outside of this bubble and find real people, really get to know them and write about them, because I think that's really important. This can be a very provincial place to me, Hollywood, because there's a big wide world out there with a lot of great characters whose stories need to be told. And I guess I've just never been that person that thinks that I can only write about the I, that my voice is the only voice worth listening to. I've just never assumed that that was the case, because feeling like I'm outside.
I hear this thrown around a lot that people should only write what they know. Are you a proponent of that?
I am a proponent of it in the sense that you can get to know a lot of things. You can get to know, for example, somebody I'm really getting to know right now is a major in the US Air Force, who lives in Florida. She's fantastic. I get to know her and I can write about her because I know her. I invest time in her. I talk to her. I interview her. Yeah, you can get to know a lot of things. You get to know dinosaurs. You can spend time like doing the research and then you can write about dinosaurs. But that doesn't, that whole idea of identity writing, the meaning that I can only write about a black female from Dallas because that's my identity, I think that's like, I think that's limited. I think as writers, we can be adventurers, we can be pioneers, we can go out there and get to know a lot of things and be empathetic to that and then put that through what we know to be the craft of story and share it with the world. I think that that's actually is that's where the artistry of what we do comes through.
Yeah, exactly. I just hear it a lot from my writer friends that try to pitch things. They often hear, well, why are you the person to tell this story? And if they don't have a very, very personal answer as to why, it's often not really considered seriously. And I'm not a writer, but I know as an actor also, and as a producer and what I'm trying to do now, like the whole joy of this profession is it is about the curious mind. It is about exploration. And as you speak of very often, it's about empathy. And you can't build empathy if you're not curious and open. And we have to all be respectful of each other, and understand that we'll never fully be able to live someone's experience, but we may as well try to understand.
Yeah, I hear you. The identity art is it's upsetting. I actually think those I've heard that before. I've heard that before on pieces I've written where people are like, "Well, you're not a gay female. Why should you be writing about this particular story? Or you're not, luckily they didn't say you're not a white supremacist, so why should you write Boyd?" But like that didn't happen. wonder why that didn't happen.
Right.
But yeah, but I hear what you're saying. I think that's more of a buyer scared thing, right? They want it's easier for them to sell it. To say, oh well, she's a black woman, so of course she can write the Harriet Tubman story. Like it's to me, that's them being lazy. I feel like if you really, really love something and you really, really, really want to write it, you should just go ahead and write it and not worry about that identity thing. I think we're gonna move past that age. I really do. I foresee that.
Well, one of the really cool things, and I am jumping ahead a little bit about your career while we're talking about this and empathy, is you directed a VR short, Left Behind, and you also were a consultant for a video game. So for you, I mean, obviously, I feel like if we're effective storytellers, we have to be empathic people. And there's a certain amount that's necessary for an audience to even invest in the story and care about what's going on. But is this interactive media, in your feeling, the future of how we can dig even deeper into having, you know, empathic communication or enlightenment or new awarenesses beyond just watching a TV show or a film?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think all of these tools, it's like when a painter gets to work with watercolor or acrylic or, you know, or digitally, you know, like all these new tools are just new ways to access story, right? So I have loved doing the narrative, working on the narrative for Battlefield Hardline. It was the first time I really had to come at a story, and I think we did about 2 years worth of work, really had to come at a story from first person point of view. And so that's a whole nother way of thinking. TV is always, you know, typically it's 2D. You're not thinking about putting yourself in the hero's shoes and taking the hero on that journey. It's affected a lot of the way that I write. I think I was able to bring a lot of that to Station 19, actually. What does it really feel like to be a firefighter in the middle of a fire? Like, I was really thinking about that creatively as we started to develop stories, that coming at it from a first person point of view, which I feel like a huge swath of our audiences today truly understand because they're gamers. And then the virtual experience is amazing too. Crafting for virtual, first of all, it's a brain teaser. Figuring out how to do it, it's so sound motivated. You really can direct the participants' experience through sound. The sound tells you where to look. You hear the dishes in the kitchen. Like, it sounds, sound directs. And so that changed a lot of how I approach sound in my story. I don't think there's any mistake that a movie like A Quiet Place could have an impact. The absence of sound is story in itself, right? So like, there's those are more like tools to play with that help you develop stories. So I love playing around in those different arenas because I always take something away from it that enhances the 2D experience. But also, you know, we're already at the age where we can deal with much more multi-level experiences. We just haven't gone mainstream yet, but they will, and they'll happen quickly. Look how quickly the whole digital conference aesthetic has infiltrated a popular culture. It could happen so quickly. Yeah. You could have a completely new aesthetic for storytelling, for communication, just like wildfire take over. And I just feel like, as a popcorn television maker, it's my job, you know, to play in all those different arenas.
What I find exciting is typically I feel like those, and I haven't engaged with a lot of VR personally, but I know a lot of them are action, horror, those kinds of things, which are great. It's really fun to be in that kind of a situation, but to also use it just in drama or in like political, social, or historical environments as well. Mm-hmm. And as a method to expand empathy, not just from, you know, high octane stuff, but from like what you did with your short and what other people can do in telling a love story, perhaps. You know, how can we expand our capacity for awareness and empathy in these different genres?
See, VR, things that blew me away about VR actually were things like reading about reports from its uses in medicine, right? So the idea that you could take a burn victim, put them in a VR icy cold experience, and their body temperature will drop. Things like that is mind-blowing to me because, I mean, what we do as storytellers and people who are creating these pieces is we are tapping into the imagination. And if you think about having a tool as powerful as virtual reality, powerful enough that it not only can hijack's not the right word, but it's pretty close, hijack your imagination and then affect how your brain is perceiving your reality deep, so deep. I'm fascinated by it. And it also scares me because I know it can be used for good. It can be an empathy machine that is used to really create good. It could also be used for destruction.
All right. So this is a question from my writer friend. And he asks, what do you think an aspiring TV writer's portfolio should look like? Some people say you should have one or two pilots. Others say a pilot and a feature or even a play. And some people say that specs are still essential. So do you think the industry as a whole has a preference, or just whatever you want to do?
I'm going to slightly disagree with all of those suggestions.
Okay, great. That's why you're the mentor.
Okay, so by the way, this changes all the time. I do think, for one, that in television there are three staples. I call them the milk, the eggs, and the bread of television. That is something in law enforcement, something in the legal field, and something in medicine. And so that's a doctor, a cop, lawyer. Having a, if you're gonna write a spec of one of those, right? So, write a spec of, and choose something that everybody may know. I would say go for the Grey's Anatomy at this point. Go for the different shows that are just the NCIS, whatever it is, standard, broadcast, robust, procedural. Because those are jobs that are, they're gonna come back every single year. So there's that. Then outside of that, originals. Don't even bother. Don't spec, the hot show. What's the hot show from last year? Probably HBO Succession. Don't go spec Succession. What you want to do is write a short, meaning a short film, like say a 20 to 30 pages max. A one-act play would be great. Short stories are good too. They still work. A reason I say short is, these executives, they get, hundreds of PDFs. That feature, they
Keep it
might read
short.
the first 30 pages in the last 10. They
Keep it
might.
bite-sized.
It's too much. And the pilot, avoid. A pilot is the hardest thing you're ever going to have to write because you have to world build, you have to say that it's going to have, this many tentacles and legs to go forward in story. It's too hard for a new writer. Write a short that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if you love a show like a Succession and you feel like, well, that's the kind of show I'd love to write for, then write about a family. You know what I mean? Like, take your favorite shows and boil them down to the essence of what that show is and then come up with your version. That's a better idea than trying to like come up with a pilot. Pilot's single hardest thing you're ever gonna have to write. Super hard. So harder than feature.
For the aspiring writer, how much focus should they be putting on getting representation?
I'm gonna say 5%. 5% under the heading of 20% of your time thinking about networking, meaning getting out, meeting people, building your network of people, and include in that 5% places where you might run into representation. And I mean physically run into representation. I'm not talking about cold calling. I'm not talking about send, don't even bother sending emails, all this stuff. Because here's the truth. And this is true for me. And this was years ago. My agent was there when I got the job. When you get the job, you will have plenty of people that are ready to take 10% of your money. Don't go around looking for ways to give away 10% of your money. Instead, keep writing, write better. Put stuff, put up a reading and invite. If you've met them in your networking, that 5% you met somebody, you thought they were cool, invite them to see your reading and, send them the link to your latest thing. Do something where it's more interactive. You've made a connection with that person. It's not just a cold thing. It's telling you it's gonna pay off way, way better. My first manager I got before the agent was somebody who I had that job at the agency. I followed up with one of those agents. He introduced me to that man who became my manager. So that was that connection. And then for my first agent, I didn't get my first agent until I had my first job. That's the truth. So 5%.
Yeah,
Don't
so
put any more than that.
just keep hustling. Just keep going.
Absolutely. Let me tell you, their job is to sell you. So the whole idea that you would go around trying to sell yourself to them is backwards thinking. Don't think like that. They'll be there. When you're ready to make money, they'll be there.
If you were starting your career at the beginning right now, where would you be looking? You said you're going back to unscripted, you're working on that. Where is the clearest point of entry, you think, for an aspiring producer?
I think the clearest point of entry for an aspiring producer right now is producing the web short, producing something that could be put up on YouTube or even doing the live stream, something like that. It's somebody who's not going to be looking for a studio, a network, or a distribution channel. Somebody's going to go direct from the creation of whatever it is, producing, to putting it out there. Because that's another way where reps are going to find that. They're going to say, oh, wait a minute, this person got, 10,000 followers. What is that? They'll come. So for a producer right now, I think it's direct to consumer. That's
Okay.
really how you should be thinking.
And do you have anything you'd be willing to share? I think you may have answered this somewhere else before, but just in terms of your general writing process, rituals, habits.
Sure. I mean, it's a hard time for me right now because I've been having insomnia issues. Because typically what I do is I'll try to wake up before the sunrise and do some meditation, some quiet time. And then that's when I'll write and I'll jot down ideas and whatever. But I've had some sleep disruptions, so I've been trying to actually sleep through sunrise a little bit. Which is, I literally this week, it was crazy. I woke up after the sun was up and I like kind of had a mini panic. I was like, oh! Like that hadn't happened to me in a long time. Because normally that's my process. And I'm sure I'll go back to it. I just need to catch up on some sleep right now.
Everything's changed. Yeah, don't worry about it.
But yeah, typically, like I do my best writing from say 6 in the morning. Then by the time we're at lunch, noon, I'm spent. Then I spend the rest of the day getting ready to figure out what I'm gonna write for the next day. So whether that's research or, going out, meeting with people, interviewing, going into a room, whatever it is, that's usually by lunchtime I'm done. But that's 6 hours. That's a good day of writing. You can get a lot done if you do that every day. I try to take at least one day off. You need to take time off. Take walks, super important. Take a break. I truly believe in the active phase, which is the actual writing, and then the diffuse phase, which is when you're in the shower, taking a walk, gardening, yoga, work, whatever it is. Like that's when the creative connections come to the brain.
Do you have any resources that, and this can really be anything, this could be a poet, this could be a book, this could be technical, that you would share with us?
Let's see. I mean, like I told you, the master class, man. I'm loving master class right now. I read a lot of nonfiction just because I don't know. I really enjoy that. There's an essay right now, a book of essays called Pretty Bitches.
Pretty bitches.
It's a collection of essays by all these different women, and they're talking about words that are used in society that kind of have double meanings for women. So words like princess or lucky or bitch, like what does that really mean? And like it's kind of the taking back of some words that have sometimes negative consequences for women, or even that they were presented as supposed to be positive, but they really undermine what the power that women can bring to the world. So I love it because it's like it's the dissection of words and how words can take on new meanings. So I'm really in love with that book. There's a book that I think is really great. It was written by a friend of mine. Her name is Mary Lou Belly, and she wrote a book called Directors Tell the Story. And she teaches the Warner Directing Workshop. I was really impressed with that book because I think that's a great go-to for if you just want like a tool book, to kind of read, because it really takes some things I never thought about, things I just learned from doing, and boils it down and presents it in a way for somebody who maybe has never been on a professional set before. You could come away from that book with a lot of great knowledge. I like that one. I'm also trying to learn some cinematography stuff. Wait, I have this book. I'll show you. The truth is, cinematography is like it's like my weakest link right now. Okay, so like I have this philosophy that you're only as strong as your weakest link. And for me, it's cinematography. I just never really studied it. I have to rely a lot on, the cinematographers that I work on. I don't necessarily speak their language, So this book was recommended to me by a great director named Glenn Winter, and it's called The 5 C's of Cinematography. And I really am liking that too.
Thank you for those resources. And really, thank you just so much for your time today and for being who you are. You really are such an inspiration. You have got to take Spike Lee up on his offer to teach. And I just like to end with a little inspirational Wendy Calhoun quote they can take home with them.
Oh my goodness, that's pressure. That's pressure. The quote that has really been resonating with me lately, and it's not—I'm not going to quote myself. This is somebody else's
Okay.
quote. Okay, here's the quote that I love right now. Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. Winston Churchill. And I think that's the truth. I think that's the truth.
Yes, thank you so much, Wendy. Stay well and stay healthy.
You too, Jeremy. Thanks for inviting me to do this.
And thank you, friends, for tuning in. We had a lot more to cover with Wendy, so fingers crossed we'll get her back on the show really soon. If you'd like to stay up to date with Wendy, check out her website at www.wendycalhoun.net. And by the way, if you ever have questions you'd like to submit for a guest, follow us at Movie Mentors Podcast on Instagram and on our Facebook page to keep tabs of who's coming on the show and to submit your questions early. As always, please spread the word about us. Tell your friends, tell your family, give us a rating, a review, a subscribe. It only takes a second. I want to thank Christopher Battaglia, Michael D., and Gabe Sokoloff for the music on this episode. Be well, everybody. Take care.